Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Critically Acclaimed, the movie review podcast where there's an explosion sound effect. And then I go, wee! My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a film critic, one that is nearby explosion sound effects, as it turns out, which has everything to do with film criticism.
Yes, 100%.
You know what? We did review a film this year called Tick, Tick, Boom.
I think that counts.
So it's all justified. All these years we've been using it.
How many explosions do you think you've seen in your career as a film critic?
Right? At least 10 too many.
just the 10?
You know what?
We've probably seen thousands upon thousands of explosions.
When it's like a bunch of B filmmakers who are just sort of like running around the streets of Los Angeles setting cars on fire, that's exciting.
Oh, very exciting.
Or Brian Trenchard-Smith is out in the outback of Australia blowing up cars. That's fun.
Yeah.
When it's a head exploding,
Also, fun.
I am there, 100%.
Scanners,
a head, a body part, a human body. Just
you ever see The Fury?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
They filmed that explosion from 13 separate angles.
And they used every single one.
It's amazing. Amy Irving makes big eyes at John Cassavetes, and John Cassavetes explodes.
It's worth the price of admission.
But when it's like a CGI explosion of a gigantic Harrier jet or an aircraft carrier or a lab... I'm tired of that stuff.
I'm how tired you are of labs exploding. When was the last time a lab exploding thrilled you? Because I can name mine.
I can't even think. Like when I first started seeing it when I was a kid, mm-hmm. in like Saturday morning cartoons or comic books.
Yeah,
I always felt bad for the lab.
Yeah,
the lab is innocent in this. The lab is actually a lot of expensive equipment. Usually when the lab blows up, it's a symbol that it's the villain's lab. And it's a symbol that the villain has died.
And their plan has
been foiled.
Yeah.
And hoisted by their own petard, something horrible happens and their lab explodes. And there's lab technicians running around. Something that started, I think, in James Bond movies.
I think it started in like Universal Horror movies. Like Frankenstein's lab explodes and Bride of Frankenstein.
I was going to say, maybe earlier precedent would be like an old serial where there's a fight and there's a fire in the room with the fight.
Commando Cody, that kind of thing.
Yeah. I always wanted them to salvage the lab. Mm. It's like, oh no, let's fight. Oh, no, don't hit that. We can actually use this the supercomputer that the supervillain clearly put a lot of time and resources into for benevolent purposes. We can use this to help us.
Theoretically.
No, let's just blow it up. What a waste.
The last
I always felt so bad. It was such a waste of resources.
The last time I was thrilled by a lab explosion was way back when I saw Darkman in theaters.
Okay.
Because in Darkman, at the beginning, there's a lab explosion at the beginning, and it's the hero's lab.
Mm.
And they really mess him up and like dump chemicals onto him and everything. It was what's happened in the Darkman.
Burnt up and has no skin.
But they have this thing where they have this one of those drinky birds, you know, the ones that go bob up and down and ignite the thing that makes it explode. And he's just like crawling, trying to get to that before it makes the lab explode. And he just misses it and it turns him into Darkman. Like that right there, because he had that level of suspense and the drinky bird. I have lived my entire life wanting that drinky bird.
You can still get them.
You can. You know where you can't find them? Just out and about.
You have to go to like a Cracker Barrel gift shop.
Yeah, you have to go
something.
To like some kind of novelty store. But like, you don't just like go to the market and pick up, you know, eggs and cheese and broccoli and drinky birds. You don't just have them there.
Go to Archie McPhee. Archie McPhee will have them.
I don't know who he is.
Oh, Archie McPhee is, they're like one of the bigger manufacturers of like novelty widgets and knickknacks. Like
they make like fake vomit and stuff.
Like if you want a small hand, you can fit on the end of your fingertip. That's Archie McPhee. If you, it's not just vomit, like horse masks, bacon flavored unicorn poop, you know, that just the usual kinds of hipster stuff.
Something that's always bothered me about fake vomit. Mm, who modeled the vomit? Like what are they trying to recreate? Like whose vomit? What day was it?
Fake vomit. We'll get to movies, by the way.
We got movies. We're reviewing West Side Story, Being the Ricardos, and Red Rocket, but this is more important right now.
I'm going to look up Archie McPhee. I'll tell you what some of their stuff is.
Okay.
But the fake vomit that you get from the novelty shop never looks like vomit. It looks like a puddle of like milk with dog food around the edge.
Yeah.
And vomit never falls like that. And it's also like a little teeny tiny pile.
Oh, yeah.
It's like nobody vomits just that much.
Yeah.
If they do, you know, they wouldn't like vomit really on trying the floor. So hard,
really. It's more of acid reflux than anything else.
So I've always been sort of upset that fake vomit doesn't look like it needs to be a big rubber sheet you can roll out.
I just wondered, there must have been like at some point. Mm-hmm. It's like when they decided that like what in Fahrenheit, what's like body temperature? It's like 98.6.
Yeah, 98.6 degrees.
98.6 degrees. That's kind of arbitrarily chosen, isn't it? We just took someone's temperature and like, 98.6. I guess that's fine now. Like, I feel like that's it for fake vomit. Like, one point they found some vomit and they're like, okay, it looks like that. I'm like, really? We don't want to like test other vomits? Like, nah, this one's fine. I'm sure it's typical. And then it turns out, no, we've been lied to all our lives.
See, Archie McPhee will give you bandages with Bigfoot on them.
Nice.
Very small rubber chickens.
How small are we talking about here?
Like about an inch long.
That's very small rubber chickens.
Yeah. Crows, finger crows, you can put on the ends of your fingers.
Adorable.
A wind-up peanut being driven by an opossum.
Good.
A lawn ornament that is Bigfoot in a lotus position.
Done.
A dead opossum wearing a Santa suit.
Aw.
Not a real dead opossum.
Oh, thank God. Yeah. Okay.
A dead opossum air freshener.
Mm.
A stress tardigrade. It's a little squeezy stress ball in the shape of a tardigrade, the microscopic creature.
Weird.
Emergency googly eyes, 500 googly eyes in a tub, bandages that look like bacon, deluxe rubber chicken, full size.
Good.
If you remember those little rude saying button push devices?
Like keychains, or you just press it and like, say, kiss my butt. Yeah, yeah, that kind of thing.
You smell.
Shut up.
This one will give you compliments if you push buttons.
See, that's nicer. Why didn't we start with that?
But yeah,
why didn't we start with that? That's such a better idea.
Go to McPhee, McPhee, McPhee.com, and you can see all the Archie McPhee stuff. I used to be obsessed with Archie McPhee, and I would order stuff from them all the time, and then I kind of got over it.
Yeah.
Speaking of getting over it, we're talking about some big Oscar contenders this week.
Yeah, really big. We're only reviewing three movies this week, but these are big films.
Yeah, in terms of awards attention.
In terms of pedigree. Yeah. We're talking about, again, we're talking about Steven Spielberg's remake of West Side Story. We're talking about Aaron Sorkin's Being the Ricardos, about the making of the I Love Lucy show. And we're talking about Red Rocket, which is from the director of the Florida Project, right?
Yeah, Sean Baker.
Sean Baker. I forgot his name for a second. Do you want to just dive right in?
Sure. What do you want to talk about first?
Well, I feel like West Side Story has the biggest imprimatur.
Oh, okay.
Even though it's kind of, people would say it's underperforming at the box office.
Oh, whatever.
I would argue that there's still a pandemic going on and people aren't necessarily flocking unless it feels like a cultural event, which is what the superhero movies do and not what musicals do.
No. Well, not currently, although this has been a great year for musicals.
Actually, yes, it has.
Because this is actually quite a good version of West Side Story. It feels like a revival. I want to compare it to Kenneth Branagh's remake of Murder on the Orient Express, where you kind of know the original. The original will always be the
good
one.
Yeah.
But this is like a really fun revival of something you know really well.
It's a perfectly valid version of it. It's basically the same story. They make a few changes. Mostly the story changes, I think, are for the better. Regardless, it's like, it's just new cast, new cinematographer, a new director wanted to put their stamp on it, and it's Spielberg, and he'd never directed a musical before, which is weird if you think about it. He kind of just flitted about between genres, but he never did a whole musical. He did musical numbers. The opening of Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom is a musical number and a pretty good one. It's 1941 has like an amazing like Zoot Suit Riot sequence.
I have not seen 1941.
It's a little underrated. I think it's it's not great. It's like it's way too big for its britches and it goes all over the place. But when it's good, it's amazing.
But yes, this is based on the 1961 film. It has the great Jerome Robbins choreography intact. Mm-hmm. It has the same score intact, but now slightly reinterpreted by Thomas Newman. And it's the same story. It's inspired by Romeo and Juliet, but set in 1950s New York, the west side of New York. And it's about the white JDs. And
JD stands for juvenile delinquents
and the Puerto Rican immigrants, and how the two rival gangs, the Jets and the Sharks, come to blows over a romance that springs up between Tony and Maria. Tony in this version is played by Ansel Elgort. Maria is played by Rachel Ziegler in her first movie.
And you'd never know. She's good.
She avails herself quite well.
Yeah.
He not so much. He's actually the weakest part of this movie.
And by far.
Yeah, Tony, the character of Tony is kind of a wet blanket anyway, going back to the 1961 version. He's actually also the least interesting character. But what we need from Tony is the songs. We need the music. We mm-hmm. need him to sing Something's Coming. We need him to sing Maria.
Mm-hmm.
And Ansel Elgort isn't quite bringing it. He's bringing like 75%.
Yeah, it's Ansel Elgort is... there's a saying in the theater, at least when I was doing theater, this was a saying, which is your cast is only as good as its weakest link. Because you either have to act at their level, or you have to act around them, and then they're going to look bad.
Mm.
Ansel Elgort in this movie, and frankly, I've never seen him be particularly good in anything. Like he was okay in The Fault in Our Stars, but I wasn't impressed. He was just okay. Sort of fine.
Kind of rubbed me the wrong way in The Fault in Our Stars. I thought it was really grating. Yeah.
But regardless,
I saw him in which YA adaptation was he in? It was the either Divergent or Hunger Games. One of those.
He wasn't in either of those. He was, I think, in the remake of Carrie. If memory serves.
Oh, was he? Okay.
I think he played the John Travolta role.
He's a little bit of a non-entity when it comes to screen charisma, and that's death in a musical.
Well, it doesn't work here for a variety of reasons. He's like functional, obviously. He's doing the choreography. He's hitting the notes. Mm. But you say all we really need from Tony is the songs. I disagree. I think we need the songs, but I think we need to see passion.
Mm.
We need to see this, I'm willing to throw everything away for this perfect romance that I perceive, and I think it's true for any Romeo and Juliet story. And I look at Ansel Elgort in this movie, and I see no inner world behind his eyes.
Well, this comes to another sort of vague issue. This isn't a big problem with the movie, but I feel like the music is dead on. Spielberg knows it's great music anyway, but mm-hmm. they're able to, it's really, really well produced. Mm-hmm. The choreography is really, really great. And Spielberg is the type of filmmaker who knows to edit less and move the camera less, especially when it comes to dancing. So we see the dancing and we're impressed by it. Gorgeous.
This is a textbook. Here's how to film a dance number in a movie in the modern era. Yeah. It's really good. It's
been so frustrating having to suffer through this entire 15 to 20 year period of filmmakers not knowing how to make musicals.
Or having casts who can't pull it off and having edit around them. And then either way, we still don't get a great looking musical.
Yeah.
So regardless, it sucks.
Chicago won Best Picture at the Academy Awards. It is a terrible film. It's a good musical. I like Chicago as a musical, but
as a movie, it doesn't work.
It's edited to shit. And, and not everybody was really proficient in song and dance. So they kind of had to cut around a lot of it.
Yeah.
In this, they're proficient in song and dance. And most particularly, Ariana DeBose, who plays Anita.
Mm.
And,
which is the role that won
Rita Moreno an Academy Oscar Award.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Mike Faist, who plays Riff, who's sort of the... I guess he's sort of the Mercutio character.
I guess he kind of is. Yeah, he's kind of a cross between... I guess he's kind of a cross between Renvoli and Mercutio. It's not a perfect one-to-one. Because he's instigating the fight. Mercutio tried to stay out of it, but then he ended up dying.
Yeah.
Here he's kind of both. Mike Faist, and is it Anita DeBose?
Ariana DeBose.
Ariana DeBose, sorry.
Plays Anita. The character is Anita.
Yeah, I see how I did that. They are powerhouses.
Yes.
They are, watching them on screen, I don't think I've ever seen them in anything before. They both have some credits, but mostly I think they come from theater. I'm trying to remember the last time, because Rachel's in this really good too, but these two in particular, you watch them on screen and you're just like, where have you been?
Yeah, well,
we needed you.
Ariana DeBose has been on stage mostly.
Yes.
She was in Hamilton, and she was also, I think she was the girlfriend in The Prom, but the girlfriend was this background character.
Yeah. But yeah, Mike Faist hasn't been in a lot.
I remember when La La Land came out and I do not like La La Land. I think the music and the dancing aren't there in La La Land, which is kind of the point of La La Land.
I think it opens strong. That opening number is quite good, but none of the cast is in that.
It's it's a good idea, but more than it is a good movie. And I argued at the time that you could go to New York and go to like any deli or restaurant, talk to the waiter or waitress who is clearly an aspiring actor as well, and just cast them at random, and you'd get better performances than the movie stars we got.
I'm with you. You put Mike Faced and Ariana DeBose in La La Land. Oh my God, would that movie be actually the best movie?
It'd
be absolutely. They are electric. They understand the material. They understand the tone. They can sing amazingly. They dance incredibly. These are like the featured supporting players. Mm-hmm. It's not like they're like little tiny roles. They're big roles, but you know they're not the big roles in the movie. They're amazing. Everyone in this movie is either exceptionally good or genuinely amazing, except Ansel Elgort, who is like barely fine.
And I feel like and Rachel Ziegler, she sings very, very well.
Yeah, she's great.
But I feel like in this version of West Side Story, the romance is given the shortest shrift.
Yeah.
And so she is unfortunately kind of...
She's trapped.
She's trapped by, A, the conveniences of the story, and also her lack of chemistry with Tony, which we can point back to Ansel Elgort on that.
Again, you're only as good as your weakest link here. And when your entire story resides on, this was a passionate and... West Side Story is a very chaste version of Romeo and Juliet. I've always kind of been frustrated by it, just because it just I never really, even in the original movie, which is a great movie.
I like that movie a lot.
Tony is also kind of the weak link in that movie, too. He's just kind of not very interesting, and I always feel like we're fighting for this not very interesting romance, and I think that's a danger here. You want your Romeo and Juliet, however you're doing it straight, you're doing a musical, you're doing some kind of vampire version, whatever you're doing. I don't care. It's a plot that's been done a million times. If you want it to work, we have to believe that these two people are so into each other. It could be love. It could just be lust. Whatever it is, they're so into each other that they're willing to throw everything else away for it. Because at some point in our lives, hopefully, we know what that feels like. If we don't believe that, the movie doesn't work. So as much as... almost every part of this movie is amazing. The cinematography is astounding. The choreography is astounding. Mm. The restaging is astounding. 98% of the cast is astounding. But because the one person in the cast who is, like, mediocre at best, here, like, he's technically proficient, but he's just not bringing anything interesting to it. Because of that... it drags the movie down. The movie is not bad. It's still very, very good. But I think about, like, if you had gotten, like, a young Brando type, you know, someone who actually had like some real,
and that's kind of what they're going for.
Yeah, they added some backstory to him where he was like a little bit darker.
What they did with this movie is Spielberg made it more like a movie, so there's actually a lot more dialogue. It's a little talkier than a stage production would be.
Yeah,
so they've expanded a lot of the non-singing parts of this musical, which, as it turns out, kind of drags down the whole pace of the thing. I feel like it doesn't have the kind of zip and the jump to the next number that it kind of needs. Mm-hmm. When the music is playing and everybody's dancing, this movie is alive.
Yeah.
Everything in between, we're kind of like settling in and waiting for the next song to start. And because this is the kind of movie where you're going to be humming the songs going in, you're waiting for the big songs. I feel like Spielberg did add a lot to this movie, compared to the stage production, compared to the other movie, that do enhance it.
Yeah.
For one, he changed the setting to not just a neighborhood in New York, but a neighborhood in New York that is in the midst of being torn down.
Yeah.
We see, there's a lot of cranes and construction equipment and buildings and empty lots.
It looks like the neighborhood from Battery is not included. Right down to, like, a lot of the location is at, like, this one kind of, like, drugstore, malt shop, whatever, that's in the middle of a block with nothing else.
Yeah.
Like, it's all been ripped out. Yeah.
So, the battle between these two gangs, they're battling over a neighborhood that's essentially going to be gone soon, which sort of highlights the tragedy and I think adds a heck of a lot of texture to the story.
Yeah, the element of futility to it.
Yeah.
It's going to be the last person on the shrinking iceberg.
I really liked that. They gave the Somewhere song, There's a Place for Us, not to Tony and Maria, but they gave it to Rita Moreno, who plays the owner of one of the shops.
Yeah.
She's back in this movie.
Different role, obviously.
She's 90 now, so she can't play Maria anymore. She could have. Why not?
Fuck it. Let's do it. I'll watch that.
Rachel Ziegler was fine. I don't want to replace her. But she in because she's singing somewhere there's a place for us. Mm. The meaning of the song changes. It's not about two people being in love, because where it comes in the musical is would be at this really weird point where Maria just learned that Tony committed this horrible act of violence.
Everyone's kind of at their lowest, yeah, basically.
And it's supposed to be about, you know, reestablishing hope in their, yeah, relationship.
There's hope, but there's also a little bit of futility. Like, this is a dream we're having. Like, there's a place for us somewhere. Place for us. You know,
hold my hand. We're halfway there.
Sure, but you're in your apartment.
Rita Moreno sings it, and it becomes a lot more about just the immigrant experience, mm-hmm, about there's a place for us somewhere in this country.
Yeah.
America will accept us somewhere. It actually
sort
it's
of really good
underlines that sense of futility.
I think it's a really good change. I really do. I think it's a smart play. Mm-hmm. It's maybe the boldest deviation from the original material. Mm-hmm. And it's a good idea. I'm glad they did it. I think it's smart.
Spielberg restored some of the song order in the 1961 film. The song "Cool, Stay Cool, Boy."
Yeah,
came after the Rumble.
Yeah,
and everybody's freaking out, and everybody's sort of you know, there's some violence at the Rumble, and everybody's on edge, and like action is getting really intense. And they sing the song "Stay Cool," but it's kind of jazzy and intense in unto itself. That's a good spot for that song. In this version, they put that before the Rumble, and it's actually a conversation between Tony and Riff. I love the choreography where they're kind of like handing a gun back and forth between the two of them on this soundstage.
Well, Riff is saving it. Like, Riff is doing a great job in that bit. But like, I actually think in that case, I think that actually was kind of better in the original. I think it makes a little bit more sense in that spot, you know? Pacing-wise.
This is a small detail, but there's almost a bit player, a side character named Anybody's. And Anybody's in the 1961 film is presented as sort of this tomboyish character, this young woman who wants to be one of the Jets. And she's not allowed to be one of the Jets because she's a girl.
Yeah.
In this version, he is explicitly a trans man.
Yeah.
And wants to be one of the Jets. And this is the 1950s. The Jets still see him as female.
Yeah.
And
they can't wrap their head around it.
Yeah, and they can't accept that. They don't understand it. And when they finally accept him as one of the Jets, I mean, it's a gang. It's part of this like futile gang war.
Yeah, and it's actually kind of like
this small tender moment for this side character that you know, actually kind of gives that character validation.
Yeah, it was another good change. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of genuinely good changes to the material here. A few where I think it's more of a lateral move, like even moving Be Cool. To Be Cool?
I think it's just called Cool.
Cool. But, moving that around, I like it better where it was in the original film, but it's fine here. Like, it doesn't really ruin the film in any meaningful way. Just maybe pacing would have been stronger.
G. Officer Krupke is like
such a good number.
One of my favorite of all Broadway numbers.
It's a great number in general. And this staging of it's really fun.
Yeah, they're in the police station in this staging of it, and it's all the side characters are saying G. Officer Krupke, and in this one it's just a bunch of guys goofing around.
Yeah.
It's really silly.
Yeah, it's a silly number. Officer Krupke isn't in the scene.
And in fact, in the original staging of West Side Story on stage, G. Officer Krupke went after the Rumble. That was supposed to be like the lighthearted number.
Weird.
It's like, that is the wrong place for that number.
That's a horrible place for that number. My God, it's Romeo and Juliet. It gets more intense. Yeah, you don't want to break the tension completely. What are you doing?
G. Officer Krupke is such an upbeat number.
I mean, here in this version, I think it's the original as well, you still get the Maria's I Feel Pretty, and that comes after the Rumble, but she doesn't know what's happened yet. Mm. So there's this element of tragedy to it. Like, she still thinks everything is wonderful. She's still, you know, tiptoeing through the tulips, and it's just a matter of time before someone gives her the news that everything has gone to hell.
Yeah.
So that bit is beautifully staged here. But it's got the element of, like, but she doesn't know yet. Mm. So it taints it in a really incredible way. Janusz Kaminski has done almost every single Spielberg film since Schindler's List. I think every single one.
Oh.
Maybe Tintin doesn't count or something like that, but like...
Let me look up Janusz Kaminski, but...
I'm pretty sure he's done every single one that Spielberg's done, and they clearly, like, work well together. Mm. Janusz Kaminski has a look... He likes to sort of bleach out not in an artificial way, just sort of like he likes muted palettes. He likes windows with sun, with the sunlight blowing out of it, so you can't even see out the window, and it creates these giant shafts of light.
War of the Worlds, Munich, Crystal Skull.
Yeah,
He did do Tintin.
Yeah, okay, okay. I mean, there's
no,
he did do Tintin.
No,
okay.
No cameras in that, but he did. Yeah. I guess he did like artificial lighting.
Well, that's still lighting. You still have to figure out where the light sources are coming from.
Warhorse, Lincoln, BFG, The Post, Ready Player One, and West Side Story.
So pretty much everything.
And he's all filming The Fablemans, which is Spielberg's next film.
So they've worked together since Schindler's List. He has a style, and I was frankly a little concerned because I sometimes find Janusz Kaminski's cinematography style a little drab. It's oftentimes impeccably framed, and it's telling the story very, very well, but I think he just has an aesthetic, and sometimes I don't think it always works with the same material.
He likes to wash out the frame with backlighting to the point where it's kind of, there's so much solar flare in your eye, you can't really see a lot. He started doing that with Minority Report, and he does it a lot here. In some scenes, it's really annoying. The scene where Riff is buying the gun from some, like, bad guys in a bar.
Yeah, there's so much
backlighting and solar flare that I can't see what's going on in this scene.
And so admittedly sometimes he steps over the line here too, but I was actually really impressed by how modulated his cinematography was here. And how it opens with this incredible, like, I don't know, maybe some of it was CGI, but like this big,
it looks
shot
like a oneer,
big oneer of like this town, this borough in New York that's being demolished. And It's very Janusz Kaminski. It's very, very much, it's muted color palette, kind of a light blue kind of thing going here. And yet, as the story goes on, depending on the musical number, depending on the scene, the colors can really pop. The Mambo scene, the dance off, gorgeously colorful. The America song that Anita sings, unbelievably colorful. Really nicely done. Really knowing like when to deviate from the house style, basically. Yeah. And it's a fantastic looking motion picture by any standard. I think it's a gorgeous. It's easily one of the best looking movies of the year.
It's we talk about how, you know, I feel like the pacing is really low. I feel like it's a little too talky. I feel like Tony is just not a strong element of this movie.
He's just miscast. That's all. In fact, it's weird to think about, like, Spielberg doesn't miscast very often. In fact, he's usually very good about finding actors, even actors who would be a little unexpected in their roles. And it's, this is like the biggest, like, I was like, why did you go with him?
Well,
what did he show you in the audition that I'm not seeing here?
You can tell he's going for like kind of a wild one. He's trying to get a young Brando vibe.
He has no intensity. He has no passion.
Yeah, he's not nearly as intense as a young Brando, but that's sort of what he was going for. And he comes across as a little bit of a boring character, which is kind of death for the entire musical. But
you know who
would have
weirdly been great? Barry Keoghan. It
would
have been a weird choice. I think he would have been great. If he can dance, I don't know if he can.
Yeah.
He would have had like a really interesting energy to this.
Yeah, he's too old now, but Jamie Bell would have done a great Tony back in the day.
Some people suggested Alden Ehrenreich, also a little too old now, but my God, he would have been good.
Yeah.
He would have been really good.
I feel like he would have been a good Riff, but
either one, really. Yeah.
There's too much good in this to dismiss it out of hand, though. There's actually a lot of really exhilarating stuff. And the songs and the music are right there. Yeah. They are like high Broadway quality. I feel like Spielberg really brought back to the movie musical a lot of panache that was missing from the genre until this year when we saw like four great ones.
Yeah.
Because also this year we had In the Heights and we had Tick, Tick, Boom and we had Vivo. I like the songs from Vivo. Vivo's not a great movie, but I like the songs from Vivo.
I didn't see Vivo. I feel like we're forgetting one. Cyrano isn't out yet, but that's coming up as well.
I haven't seen that.
I've heard good things, but I haven't seen it yet.
Cyrano yet.
I feel like there's at least one or two more decent, if not really good, musicals, but I digress.
Musicals, as we're learning, aren't giant business. In the Heights didn't make a lot of money.
No.
Tick, Tick, Boom got some awards attention, and I think it was cheaper to make, but... wasn't like a runaway hit or anything. And this one is rather famously tanking because it cost $100 million and made 14.
It might have domestically. Legs. It might have legs. It might just last. That's what happened to Titanic. Yeah. It's happened to The Greatest Showman.
You and I saw this in a Cineplex, and we were the youngest people in the theater by at least 30 years.
I would say so.
So,
and it wasn't packed. It wasn't packed. It was very, it was pretty sparse, honestly.
It was modestly attended, but...
Yeah, I would say about 20% full, if that.
The gigantic movies tend to be visited over and over again by a younger audience.
Yeah.
Teenagers go seeing these movies over and over. The box office power of the over 70 crowd should not be underestimated.
No.
And they're not quick to go out and see it opening weekend. But
especially during a pandemic.
But they'll see it. And this one might creep along and end up earning a little extra money. I don't really care. I think you should see the movie.
Sure.
Especially if you like musicals. Especially if you like West Side Story. This is a wonderful revisitation of familiar material with a lot of... enough added material to make it a little richer and enhance the overall West Side Story experience.
It's so frustrating that this movie, which is unabashedly great in almost every way, it just has like one... And again, I don't want you to go in there thinking this Ansel Elgort guy, who a lot of people find distasteful for a lot of reasons that have nothing to do with the movie. I'll let you Google that for yourself. I don't want you to go in there thinking that he's just... completely incompetent. It's just he's not.
He's not as good as the great performers around him.
He is at the very good regional theater vibe, and everyone else is headlining on Broadway.
He
can do it, but he isn't bringing anything extra. He isn't selling the material the way everyone else is doing. He's just doing the material, it hurts the movie. Does it hurt the movie dramatically? No, but I gotta tell you, if he had brought it or they'd had someone else who did really bring it, this could have been an all-timer.
Yeah,
and instead, it's just a very, very, very good Steven Spielberg film, which we should all be so lucky.
And I'm keeping an eye on Mike Faist. I'm keeping an eye on Ariana DeBose because they're both amazing.
Astounding. I think Mike Faist might actually... I'm not interested in Oscar prognostication, but this might be Mike Faist. He's that good.
It's like
when you watch Anne Hathaway in Les Mis and you're like, this movie isn't very good, but she's getting an Oscar. That's just this. That song, it's like Mike, that's how do you not give that an Oscar? That's what they like.
I could rewatch the opening Jets number over and over again. Just
really great.
Chewing on my fist on all those hot JD boys with their slicked hair. And their,
you gasped. You audibly gasped. You have a type.
A bunch of 50s guys, and they're walking down the street all sweaty, and they walk through like a water stream coming from a fire hydrant. It's like somewhere Kenneth Anger is smiling, chewing on my fist at all these hot boys. But that's neither here nor there.
Yeah.
It's an exhilarating number besides.
Right.
Well, you want that staged.
You want that passion. You want that to come somewhere. And if we're not going to get it from our lead, we'll take it where we can get it.
And whenever the Jets are sort of like walking abreast together, or the Sharks, whenever the gangs are walking all together in a big group, those are really great shots. Those are really fun scenes.
It's so impeccably... it's so impeccably crafted.
Yeah.
Like, on a technical level. Like, you need to see this movie. If you don't see it in the theater, I get it. But do see it eventually, if only to look at just how to stage a musical, because, my God, it's a class. And I really, really liked In the Heights. You liked it even more than I did. There's some really, really great stuff in In the Heights. They have similar material, and it's, like, it's artificial to put them up against each other. Yeah, In the Heights only has like a few numbers, I think, that compete with the staging in this West Side Story. As good as In the Heights is, and it's really good. It's just... But In the Heights doesn't have a weak member of the cast.
In the Heights is pretty solid all the way through.
So there's that. Anyway, moving on. There's another big Oscar contendery type movie from a famous storyteller. Someone who's worked in film and television. And it is Aaron Sorkin's Being the Ricardos. This is Aaron Sorkin. You know Aaron Sorkin. He did The West Wing and The Newsroom and Sports Night.
And he wrote movie screenplays besides. He did A Few Good Men, rather famously.
Amazing screenplay for A Few Good Men.
He did The American President. Mm-hmm. He did Social Network, which is...
I
really love The Social Network.
I think it's aging more poorly with every given day.
I'm waiting for the sequel is what I'm waiting for.
That's an exciting prospect that I'm interested. He did Steve Jobs, which I think is a little underrated.
But he's known for, in terms of, as a screenwriter, for a lot of complex wordplay. He likes giving people a lot of analytical talk. And a lot of banter.
Everyone in his movies is quick-witted.
In a way that I actually appreciate. I like seeing the quick-witted people. It's not that kind of like winky, jokey thing that like a Joss Whedon might do.
No,
it's
not like that at all.
It's some of his voices kind of sound the same, but it's always
that's the danger that he has. I think you look at something like Molly's Game or this. Everyone seems to have come from the same parents in the same neighborhood with the same education.
Yeah.
No matter who they are, no matter where they come from, no matter what their background is, no matter what their job is, no matter what they do, they have the exact same cadence. And I got to tell you something, man. Sometimes it works. If everyone's in the same environment, it makes sense. But when people are supposed to be disparate, it does not.
Yeah. In fact, a lot doesn't work about being Ricardo's.
Very frustrating.
This is a pretty bad movie.
I agree.
Aaron Sorkin also directed. He shouldn't direct.
Maybe he can direct, but not this.
Not this. He especially shouldn't direct the life story of a comedian, because Aaron Sorkin, while he has a little bit of wit to him, and you might chuckle at the wry humor that he injects, he doesn't really understand comedy, especially not the broad type of comedy that Lucille Ball is known for.
No, it's interesting because Aaron Sorkin clearly, because this is a story, real fast, this is a story about 1 week in the production cycle of I Love Lucy. I Love Lucy, if you've never watched it before, is a milestone in television for a wide variety of reasons. For one thing, they were the television series that said, hey, let's shoot this thing on film so that we can repackage things later and have things like reruns rather than just shoot it on shitty video and it'll always look like crap. That was a big game changer in television right now. It's the reason why I Love Lucy is still on TV in a lot of places.
Little bit of trivia. Do you know who designed the lighting on I Love Lucy? Carl Freund.
That's right.
He director of The Mummy.
Yep.
And photographer of Metropolis. Like, he worked on a lot of really high-profile Hollywood productions.
I Love Lucy.
He was hired to come in, and he invented sitcom lighting, and we're still using it to this day.
I Love Lucy is an enormously important series, and it's because the people who made it were perfectionists. They really cared a lot about this stuff. Lucille Ball was initially going to be kind of an ingenue, much like a Katharine Hepburn type. Her career never quite took off, but she was always brilliant at comedy, and she ended up veering in that direction. She ended up getting the series, and she incorporated her husband, Desi Arnaz, who was a Cuban immigrant and a brilliant singer and performer, also a very, very good actor. This is also a time when, we're going to have a married couple on television who aren't both white. That was also something that wasn't done in the 50s. They brought that into the mainstream. And the vast majority of the early I Love Lucy episodes, and even many of the later ones, were impeccably crafted joke machines where they built to these intensely elaborate, brilliantly conceived and brilliantly executed physical comedy routines. Some of these episodes have aged exceptionally well. Watch the Vitamita Benjamin episode. Like, Mike, I think it's called Lucy Does a Commercial. My God. Brilliant bits from here, from inside and out. Some of them have aged very...
Do you pop out at parties? Are you unpopular?
Some episodes are racist or sexist or have other shitty things about them that they don't air very often anymore. But the majority of them hold up really well because they're just classic vaudeville routines. And Aaron Sorkin seems to have connected to that in terms of, it's about developing and perfecting a routine. So he understands joke construction as a turn in terms of setup, payoff, and in the middle, finagling as you try to get the individual pieces just right. What he doesn't seem to understand is how to be funny. Because well, almost nothing in this movie is funny, even the parts that are supposed to be funny.
He also doesn't understand, for being a writer, he doesn't seem to understand how comedy writers operate. How they sort of like throw out ideas and try to construct a humorous scenario.
Yeah.
In this, it's almost like trying to like unlock a secret. That there's it's very process oriented, that it's very technical. Constructing a joke is a technical process.
There's a running bit
throughout being the Ricardos where Lucille Ball, who's played by Nicole Kidman in really unconvincing makeup.
The makeup look like Glenn Close. Isn't that weird?
It's a little bizarre. They tried to like change the shape of her face. It's a little really strange.
Totally unnecessary. Would have been better just not to be distracted.
Anna Faris was right there.
A lot of people could have done this.
Yeah. But the recurring bit is that Lucille Ball is... wants to do a bit where she's fiddling with flowers at a dinner table.
Mm-hmm.
And it's depicted as this kind of weird sort of meticulous, anal retentive thing that she needs to do. Like
Well, the idea is the episode that they're filming is called mm-hmm. Fred and Ethel Have a Fight. And it's about their neighbors having like a fight that might break up their marriage. So she stages a dinner with both of them to try to sort of encourage them to get back together because they're their friends. And the episode opens with her putting the dinner table together and trying to get the flowers just right.
But trying this bit, she's doing this like physical comedy bit where she's trying to get it just right. Surely that's something a comedian would just do. Like they'd sort of have the instincts to figure out how this bit would go together.
Right.
Instead, we see scene after scene of Lucille Ball running the idea by people, insisting that she do it in a certain way. Mm-hmm. It almost seems like it's therapy for her. That's mm-hmm. the way Aaron Sorkin is staging it. Hang on a second.
Okay, I'll let you go.
And he's clearly getting this wrong. Like, it's not building to any kind of important comedic impact. He's restaging a comedic bit as being psychologically important to the character. I was reminded of the Peter Bogdanovich film The Cat's Meow. And in that film, Eddie Izzard plays Charlie Chaplin.
Yeah.
And Charlie Chaplin is walking around. It's about, you know, celebrities on a boat trip. And this is...
make it simple, but yes, it's true. Technically, that's true. It's more going on in that film, but yes.
But there's a bunch of celebrities there in an enclosed space, and Charlie Chaplin is there working on his material, and he's sort of going up to people and saying, if I were to make a movie called The Gold Rush, and in it, perhaps, there's somebody eating their shoes, would that be funny? Comedians don't do that.
Now, I'm sorry, you done?
It's just emblematic of the way Aaron Sorkin doesn't understand the way this show operated, the way comedy operates, and I assume the way Lucille Ball operated.
Well,
he seems to misunderstand everything from beginning to end.
Yeah, and it's really, really frustrating to watch. And I think you're kind of right, and I think you're kind of wrong about one thing, which is, a lot of people think that you can't explain humor if it's either funny or it's not. Mm. That's not true. The problem is when you explain humor, it ceases to be funny. Once you actually get into, okay, so a humor is, it comes in a variety of forms. There's slapstick, there's cerebral comedy. Mm. Usually it comes from dashed expectations of some kind. So in order to dash expectations, you need to build up expectation and then switch it around again in a way that doesn't feel like a cheat. I did like a Twitter thread where I explained the cowbell joke in Saturday Night Live, which surprisingly went viral. It was 2 a.m. and I was just bored.
Didn't it end up getting you like a speaking gig or something?
I ended up like helping like teach a class once. It was crazy. So like it was cool, but don't get me wrong. But like I basically deconstructed the entire joke and how the joke works. And once you do that, hopefully you'll understand, like, okay, a lot goes into a joke. A lot of it is very intuitive, but you can explain how a joke works. You can explain, you can, and indeed, a lot of joke writing involves refinement.
Mm.
You can look at, like, early stand-up, like, you know, sort of, like, find, like, live shows or whatever, or, like, open mics or whatever, from, like, Patton Oswalt or other famous comedians, and they'll do their material, but it's refined when they put it on camera in like a stand-up special because they've told the joke a million times. Mm-hmm. They know what's a funny word to say in the middle of it, what's not, how to set this up, how long to pause, All of these things are intuitive, but they can also be taught and described. Aaron Sorkin is obsessed with describing them. Yeah. He's not he's not just letting any of them just happen.
Yeah.
In a way that even in a writer's room would make sense.
I appreciate, and during the course of this film, this is, you know, the dramatic week of the production of I Love Lucy, and the two big dramatic things that are happening in Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz's life. Desi Arnaz is played by Javier Bardem. Mm. Lucy was recently called out as a communist because of something in her past. She
she had a relative who was a communist back before it was the political, like, you know, red flag.
Hot button issue that became in the 1950s.
So at one point she did sign a thing saying she was part of the Communist Party, but she never really...
a member of the Communist Party, but this was a big issue because of the House Un-American Activities Committee, and she was called out in the news.
Yeah, by
this
Walter Winchell, no less.
Yeah, so this was a big heavy weight of stress. The other thing is she has to announce that she's pregnant, and there's never been a pregnant woman on television, so she has to have all these conversations with the suits. And they look sinister in their suits in a big office. And she puts her foot down and says, "Well, I'm Lucille Ball. And because I'm Lucille Ball, I get to get away with this sort of thing."
Yeah.
This is another issue I had, not with his Steve Jobs movie, but with the one with Ashton Kutcher.
Oh, yeah.
Which was just called Jobs.
Yeah.
Where, because we knew where the character was going to end up, we were totally willing to let them mistreat everybody around them in order, in the case of Jobs, mistreat everybody around them.
Their greatness has been proven by history, ergo anything they did before their greatness they did is in
the
past.
So we're willing to forgive them, or the film, rather, was willing to forgive them of a lot of their misdeeds and ill behavior because we understood, as an audience members, where they were going to go. Lucille Ball seems to know the end of the story already. So she just sort of stands up and very confidently says, "No, this is the way it's going to be because I'm Lucille Ball. I already made this."
Yeah.
And this is, we're telling this from 2021. Mm-hmm. And it feels incredibly inorganic.
No, it feels in exceptionally false. Almost everything about this movie feels incredibly false.
Nicole Kidman is doing her best to sort of mimic Lucy's mannerisms, but I feel like she's not emerging as a character.
Lucille Ball is it's tricky because she has to play Lucille Ball off camera and on camera.
Yeah.
And those are very different people. And on camera, she's as iconic a TV presence as we ever have had or ever will have. So when Nicole Kidman does the thing Lucy does, where she sort of mugs to the camera and lets her eyes go wide, we know that's wrong. It's exceptionally distracting. And when she's not playing the TV persona, she might as well just be Nicole Kidman, man. Like, she's not really selling it. She doesn't come across as Lucille Ball in any meaningful way. And that's hard to do in biopics. It's a difficult thing to pull off. I understand
act a fictionalized version of a really well-known figure.
Yeah, it's very, very difficult. You have
to balance between mimicry. I feel like Javier Bardem does a little bit of a better job.
Oh, I don't.
Because I think he's not trying to do Desi.
True.
I think he's trying to play a role a little bit better, which is, I think, better for an actor.
I will give you that, and I think he's not concerned with mimicry, which is good, because at least gives his performance a level of consistency. You can just accept it. Problem is, and this is something people talked about when Tom Hanks played Mr. Rogers in A Beautiful Day. It was A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, right?
Won't You Be My Neighbor? No, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood.
Yeah, yeah. Won't You Be My Neighbor was the documentary.
Okay.
Someone pointed this out. I wish I remember who it was, because it was a really, really good point. And I like him in that movie, but he's not really playing Mr. Rogers. He's playing Tom Hanks playing Mr. Rogers. Mm-hmm. Someone pointed out that, like, Mr. Rogers was like a cat, and Tom Hanks is more like a dog. You know? Just a little bit more energy, a little bit more in your face. And I was watching this movie, and that's how I felt about Javier Bardem. Desi Arnaz, and I never really saw a lot of footage of him off camera, but even just when he's doing the on-camera I Love Lucy shtick, Desi Arnaz was a cat. Desi Arnaz was incredibly approachable. Desi Arnaz was incredibly cuddly. Mm-hmm. At least that was the persona he gave off, and Javier Bardem was often asked to do that in this movie. Javier Bardem is a wolf. Javier Bardem
He's better when he's playing, like, heavy. Like, he's a very capable actor, but I like him when he's playing heavy.
He can be very, very funny. He can do all kinds of cool stuff. It's just, he's never convincing as Desi Arnaz here. I never buy it. Mm. I never buy that he's playing that character. I just feel like we're seeing two characters. If you had called this the I Love Trudy show, and it was about, and you just had that level of like...
sort of a fictionalized version of I Love
Lucy. I would have been 100% fine with them. They would both have been okay, but they're really distracting. I will say who are good are
William Frawley and Vivian Vance.
Yeah, played by J.K. Simmons and Nina Arianda?
Nina Arianda is her name.
Yeah. They are really, really good actors. J.K. Simmons is great, and he's not afraid to be unlikable because William Frawley can be a dick. And Nina Arianda
And they look nothing like, just like Nicole Kidman and Harvey Brodin. They don't look like William Frawley and Vivian Vance. Nobody does.
No, they're very particular looks.
We're too familiar with the way they look. I feel like the scenes with Nina Arianda as Vivian Vance and sort of the dramas that she had to put up with were really strong because Nina Arianda was so good.
Yeah.
And as it turns out, Vivian Vance had to endure a hell of a lot on that show. She was told not to lose weight.
Yeah.
Because she can't be prettier than Lucy.
Yeah.
Lucille Ball evidently said that right to her face, and that really gave her a complex.
Yeah, her bit is to be the unlovable housewife next door.
Yeah.
And that wears on you after a while when that's your whole persona to the whole world.
And it didn't help that, and this was true, she and William Frawley hated each other.
Yes, they did. It worked, though, on camera, because that natural hatred, when Fred and Ethel bickered, you knew that there was something, like, really there. Like, they really wanted to get under each other's skin. Like, it fit the chemistry, but yeah, apparently it was hell to work together.
Yeah, J.K. Simmons has a wonderful bit where he takes Lucy across the street to his favorite bar, because he's an alcoholic as well.
Yeah.
And, just sort of has a little bit of a heart-to-heart about what it is to be a comedian and actor. And he talks about his old vaudeville days, because he'd been acting for decades.
Yeah.
And I feel like that was sort of a good bonding moment between the two characters.
Yeah.
The problem was, because Lucy is such this amorphous entity in this film, we're not learning anything for her. She doesn't seem to be taking anything from that.
Mm-hmm. She's not really growing.
She's either all the way in charge or so vulnerable that she loses all character, but not in a dramatic kind of way.
It runs into this issue where you were talking about it before, this sort of great man narrative, or in this case, the great woman narrative, which is a sort of an ideology in history, which is it was changed because this person was just that good, damn it. They were that good at their job, or that amazing at warfare, or whatever the fuck. That's shitty history. That is just shitty history. That's not how life works. Not how history works. That's what we like to reduce it to simplify it.
To tell a story.
But the thing is that those stories don't necessarily do us any favors, especially in a case like this, where the whole point is to go behind the curtain. So even though we go behind the curtain, we're supposed to see everyone warts and all, this movie boils down to, if everyone listened to Lucille Ball, everything would have been fine forever.
Mm.
That's who's to say whether or not how true that is, but the point is, it doesn't satisfy dramatically. I will say this about the film. I think that some of the supporting cast is very, very good. Nina Arianda first blew me away in another biopic about the entertainment industry called Stan and Ollie.
You've talked about Stan and Ollie a lot.
Stan and Ollie might not be the greatest biopic ever made, but it might be the best example of how to do a behind-the-scenes entertainment biopic.
Mm.
Everyone in it is spectacular. Everyone is embodying their roles. All of the, like, because when you're doing stories of entertainers, you want to see them entertain. If you're doing a story about, if you're doing a biopic of Frank Sinatra and you never saw him sing, how weird would that be? But if you see him sing, he needs to sing like Sinatra. He needs to be great.
Yes.
And if he's not, then it almost would have been better if you never let him sing. Stan and Ollie knows, like, we were able to recapture the routines and we're able to make them work so that they're just as funny now as they ever were because the actors are really, really good at it. But it also showed them, like, behind the scenes in a way that was actually illuminated all of those bits that we knew. Nina Arianda plays, I think she's Stan Laurel's wife. I was getting which one was Laurel? Was he the tall one or was he the
Stan Laurel was tall and thin, was the short and thin, and
yeah,
and
Stan Laurel,
Oliver Hardy was large and thick.
Yeah. Well, in any case, she's incredible in that. I thought she should have been Oscar nominated for that. So it's good to see her do something a bit more high profile that's kind of similar. I think clearly someone saw Stan and Ollie and like, we'll just bring her back. J.K. Simmons is also great. I also think that, and I want to give Sorkin this much credit. I think the last act of the movie, when all the shit hits the fan, the variety of subplots are all coming to a head on the same night, I think structurally is very sound.
The one most dramatic week in the production of Isle of Lucy is a fine way to go about telling the story.
It's a good idea. I think the way that everything comes to a head on the night of is pretty impeccably crafted. And I particularly like the way that it turns out that the most important thing in the long run did not seem like the most important thing this week.
Yeah.
And I kind of like how insidious that is. I think there's some good writing here, but it's not executed in a way that makes sense for the characters, for the history, for the show, or for the concept of comedy. It does not work.
Yeah,
it's another one where this entire movie basically is Ansel Elgort's performance in West Side Story, where like you're doing it. I would hesitate to say it's incompetent, but you're never showing me why you're here. You're never actually showing me why I Love Lucy was the greatest. You're telling me, but you're never showing me. You're telling me, Ansel Elgort, that you're in love with this person. I'm not seeing it in your eyes.
We need to feel it. We need to make sure that...
There's something about... Aaron Sorkin is an incredibly analytical, intellectual filmmaker. Maybe paralleled only in the modern era by Christopher Nolan.
And that's a great strength of his.
It can be good. It can work beautifully with the right material. This is bad material for him.
But I feel like... because he's so analytical, just like Christopher Nolan, his films, especially the ones he directs, lack heart.
Yeah.
And when he tries to inject heart, he falls back on a lot of old, sort of really treacly Hollywood tropes, like swelling music and gigantic climaxes that feel completely unearned, because previously this has been a really kind of intellectual exercise for him.
Yeah.
That was my biggest issue with the Trial of the Chicago 7.
Mm.
The ending was this big, weepy Hollywood moment where everybody literally stands up and cheers, and it feels completely out of place with the rest of the movie, which was about, you know, like rioting and violence and courtroom case. Same with this. This is about a writer's room. This is about analyzing jokes. This is about deconstructing things. And then we have this big, gigantic, emotional climax that feels like it comes out of nowhere. It feels like he's falling back on a lot of things that he saw work in other movies, but doesn't understand why they need to be in certain movies. So we get this analytical thing with characters that aren't really well thought out, and then the climax of Patch Adams. It's kind of embarrassing.
Here's what it boils down to for me. And I was thinking about this. Like, there's a lot of jokes in the movie. Or not jokes. There are hardly any jokes, actually. There's a lot. Everyone's quick-witted. Almost no one is witty. Which is a death in a movie like this. But there's a lot of talk in the movie about how the director of this episode is just a workman-like, not very interesting director. And they're kind of going behind his back half the time. I feel that if you want to make a movie about I Love Lucy, I think you should be able to, or at least or even required, to direct an episode of I Love Lucy. I can't imagine Aaron Sorkin directing a good episode of I Love Lucy. I can't imagine it.
No.
I can't imagine it at all, and I think that just that alone is just not strong. I don't think that's not a good place to start here. It maybe could have been interesting if you tried to go completely in another direction and tried to show just how it wasn't funny and it was hellish and nothing was funny about it. But he thinks he's witty. And sometimes he can be. Not here.
Nah.
Very, very frustrating film. Very, very frustrating film.
Overall.
Also, I just want to say right now, little thing.
Uh-huh.
Little thing, but as someone who's watched a lot of I Love Lucy... some serious continuity flubs, too. Like, there's a bit where an executive producer gives a big speech, and he tells Lucy, that's the best thing I've ever written. And Lucy says, no, that was Vitamita Vegemin. An episode which wouldn't be written for another 10 episodes. Come on.
There's other little details that Aaron Sorkin clearly just didn't research.
Or didn't care. Or cared more about, like, we need to remind people of this famous scene, whether or not it fits.
There's also something that feels like it's just being included to pad out the movie, but we get a lot of flashbacks to the way Lucy and Desi first met and their courtship rituals.
Their greatest hits.
And, you know, how they moved in, what a lot of her anxieties are, and how she used to be impoverished, and now she's rich, and she wants to hang on to that. And when they first meet, she's wearing like black eye makeup. Like
yeah, she was in a movie where she was playing like someone who'd been beaten up.
Yeah, she was playing a character in a movie where she had been beaten up. I think she said by a pimp character. You look up that movie. There's no pimp character in that movie, and it's a real movie, and nobody gets beat up in that movie. Mm. So, why did Aaron Sorkin make that up?
Yeah,
did he not do research, right? Or was he just coming it up out of whole cloth because he wanted to?
There's another bit where I'm really curious if this is true. Mm. I never heard this before, but inserting it into the movie feels like a weird kind of fan service. But there's a bit where they go into the writer's room to explain that Lucy is pregnant and we want to write it into the show. So we're going to have to find a way to do that soon because we're on a clock here. Mm-hmm. Eventually she's going to be visibly pregnant and we have to deal with it on camera, or we have to commit to like having her stand behind boxes all the time.
Remember the Lennon sisters on the Lawrence Welk show?
I've seen so many soap operas where they just tried to hide that. Sometimes they get away with it. Usually they don't. But in any case, they go to the writer's room and the writers are busy talking about an episode where they go to Italy and Lucy decides to stomp grapes. Mm. And everyone's like, no one does that really anymore. That's not even a thing. And they're like, yeah, but we think it'd be funny. And we dedicate a big chunk of the scene to just trying to figure out this bit, which is one of the more famous bits in I Love Lucy, probably second only to the conveyor belt with chocolates. All right.
I want to see Nicole Kidman try to do that.
That'd be hilarious. But it's like, but we see like all of a sudden, like they're talking about this bit, and then like we get this close up of Nicole Kidman's face as she's like, I can see it. Mm. And like we see the scene as she's like stomping on the grapes, and it's like, oh, what a comedic genius. She can visualize a bit that's been described. You're not really selling it as well you think you are, Aaron. Mm. But on top of it all, we're doing this whole bit. That episode won't come up for multiple seasons. That's a long way down the road. If they came up with it early and said, we'll come up with some place with this bit later, well, fine. But it feels like you're shoving it in so that you can put in one of the most famous Lucy bits, because there's no other place in the script for it because of where it takes place.
Yeah.
And as a result, it just feels false. So much of the movie feels false. It's really frustrating.
And I'm not exactly sure what Aaron Sorkin is trying to get. Like, he wants to tell the I Love Lucy story. Clearly wants to lionize I Love Lucy.
Yeah.
It's one of the best TV shows ever made. Certainly it's one of the more important ones ever
made. At least that, if nothing else.
And to your point, it still plays. Mm-hmm. A lot of the episodes are still incredibly funny.
Watch the slowly I turn bit. Oh my God, is that one of the funniest things ever? Slowly I turn.
The bit where they try to glue a side of beef back together is really hilarious. But Aaron Sorkin, because he's not a comedian, because he doesn't come from a background of comedy, is looking at it like a TV production.
Yeah.
And he's missing a lot of the nuances of a comedic TV production.
Yeah.
And
not just a comedic TV production, not just like, oh, we're all kind of witty people standing around talking, like, no. Broad comedy, Naked Gun style comedy.
As such, it feels like he himself doesn't understand why I Love Lucy is important. He just understands that it was.
Yeah.
And so I'm missing what he's trying to tell me by pointing me toward I Love Lucy. I know it's funny. You clearly don't.
Yeah.
And I'm frustrated by your movie.
Yeah. Let's move on. There's one more film we're reviewing this week. I wasn't able to. Had to start it. I have a screener and I had to stop it. So I'm not going to review this movie. I didn't see the whole thing. It's not fair. Mm. I was intrigued by what I saw, though. Tell me about Red Rocket.
Red Rocket, latest film from Sean Baker, who previously did The Florida Project and Tangerine. Sean Baker's films are about people who are living in extreme poverty. Mm. In sort of, I don't want to say forgotten, just completely drab, overlooked portions of the United States. Mm. Tangerine was about sex workers in Hollywood, and it was filmed on portions of Santa Monica Boulevard that you do not see in movies.
Always appreciated.
He's also very fond of donut shops, and donut shops are actually a big part of Red Rocket. In The Florida Project, it was about a building project that was really close to Disneyland, where a lot of impoverished people were, and the sort of the desperation that they went through to pay rent, and it was all seen through the eyes of this little girl, and I really like the Florida Project. I think it was actually really heartbreaking, especially the end. This one is about a character named Mickey Saber. He's played by Simon Rex. And he is an ex-porn star. And he has returned to his little small town in Texas, and in Sean Baker fashion, this is the drabbest, ugliest landscape you could look at. It's filmed in widescreen, but it is only used to capture just how featureless everything is. Nothing's interesting about where this guy is. And he's gone back to hustle. He is clearly, when we first see him, he has a black eye and he has no money. He has literally just the shirt on his back. And he kind of tries to badger and banter and bug people into getting by. I've known people like this. We've seen movie characters like this before. The charming cad who tries to sweet talk their way into stuff when they really don't have any intention of making good on any of their promises.
It's interesting to me how that character can be entirely different depending on what genre.
Yeah.
But if it's a broad comedy, we're supposed to like them. And if it's a film noir, they're going to get everyone killed.
Yeah. And, you know? and this is leaning a little bit more toward film noir.
Okay.
Sean Baker also set this film in late 2016, right before the 2016 presidential election. And we actually see Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton on screens and in the background of certain scenes. And I think he is inviting us to make a comparison between this hustler character who's badgering people and trying to just kind of get what he needs to get by with a huckster like Donald Trump,
right,
who is just sort of sweet talking and has no actual skills or talent or isn't providing anything. The story, he ends up selling weed for somebody he used to sell weed for, so he gets a little bit of money. He ends up spending time at a local donut shop where he takes a shine to the 17-year-old clerk, a young girl named Strawberry. And he doesn't just see a potential romance. He kind of falls in love with Strawberry, but he also wants to get her involved in the adult film industry. Okay. So he's kind of prepping her and priming her and taking her to strip clubs. He's, you know, in his late 40s and she's 17 years old. And,
this is horrifying.
A big portion of this movie is devoted to this relationship that he's having with this girl and what he intends with this girl. And enough of it goes on that you're not really sure what kind of point of view you're supposed to be taking, away from this movie. I don't want to fall into that, trap of saying that depiction is the same as advocacy. That's sort of a rather unfortunately popular critical talking point these days. But here, because this film is 2 hours and 10 minutes in length, I think that we spend a little bit too much time with him priming this teenage girl.
You know, the depiction is not the same as advocacy, but the way we depict it can have an impact.
Yeah.
And it's also perfectly reasonable to say that the depiction of certain things, especially depending on what tone you take, how much screen time they take up, what the overall takeaway from the film is, whether it's positively, negatively, etc., can be considered by some, reasonably so, to be in poor taste. I think that's a difference that some people don't always bring about. It's like, it's one thing to say, like, it's not necessarily advocating it, but it's also not necessarily something we want to watch, which is also a fair thing to say.
Yeah.
And, I haven't seen it, so I don't know about this one, but if it rubs you the wrong way, it sounds like it could be a reasonable thing.
There's a little whiff of unsavoriness I hear. He has moved in with his ex-wife. She's Lexi. She's played by Brie Elrod. And she is also an ex-porn star. They used to star in features together, and they've since had a big falling out. The way this movie ends, I think, really cements it as a Trump metaphor, where everything goes wrong. Everything's horrible. The liar is revealed, but he still kind of gets what he wants. At the end of it, he kind of it's not that he gets away with anything. It's just that despite all his hustling and despite everybody in town finally seeing him for the liar and the callow jerk that he is, he still kind of gets a prize.
Yeah.
And I think Sean Baker might be saying something about sort of the way hustlers and liars are treated in the Trump era. Maybe. Because it's so long and because he spends so much time with these sort of love stories and a few other side characters, it's difficult to say what Sean Baker's actually trying to get at with this one. It's actually a little bit unfocused. Yeah. It feels a little bit meandery for a while. And it doesn't help that the main character is incredibly obnoxious. He's fast-talking all the time. He has he's the kind of character that you as an audience member want to argue with.
Yeah.
Like you want to say something to him just to shut him down.
Yeah.
But because you can't interact with the movie, he just gets to yammer and yammer and yammer on and keep on mistreating people. And it's a little too much to take, especially at 2 hours and 10 minutes. Right. So, well,
this is kind of my point about like when I was talking about how like just because you portray something doesn't mean you're advocating for it. Mm-hmm. You're still portraying it. And we're still stuck with it.
Yeah.
And if you're stuck with it and it's like, okay, so I'm not necessarily saying this guy is right. Yeah, you still thought we'd want to hang out with him for 2 hours. Maybe I didn't want to. Mm. That's a reasonable takeaway. And that's the danger you play when your protagonist is an asshole.
Yeah.
That's a dangerous line. Yeah. Like, oh, he's an anti-hero. Doesn't mean I want to hang out with him.
Yeah, there's a term in the adult film industry. They call it a suitcase pimp. And a suitcase pimp is male talent. Let me look up the definition because Sean Baker put it this way. Male talent who lives off female talent. They kind of like couch surf with other stars in the industry.
Right.
And he ends up getting accused of being a suitcase pimp throughout the course of this movie. So I think Sean Baker wanted to explore what is the life of this kind of a character.
Yeah.
The suitcase pimp, the character. And interesting. I'm sure at some point he might have even wanted to call it suitcase pimp, but that's not as graceful a title.
It's not as... Mm. Yeah, that's a different vibe.
I will say that Sean Baker does have a wonderful talent, and he shot this film on 16mm.
Yeah.
He likes to shoot things on kind of lo-fi film. Sean Baker is interesting in that he has stuck by his... He's sort of become this indie star in the indie film world.
Yeah.
And because he has such a lo-fi aesthetic, and likes to... Like, he shot Tangerine on a phone. He shot this on 16mm. He is not being courted by the Hollywood mainstream.
Yeah, I haven't heard him like being offered any superhero movies.
Wouldn't you love to see the Sean Baker superhero movie?
I'd be intrigued.
This film, however, Red Rocket, it is unfocused. It's a little unsavory. It's really annoying. It's the least of his films that I've seen, which is a little upsetting because I have liked his previous work. And I do think he does have a good talent for, you know, in using that sort of lo-fi film, capturing kind of a lo-fi aesthetic of a part of America that we don't see cameras pointed at. Right. But we've had a lot of great films about impoverished characters this year. I recommend the film Holler. Mm. That is an excellent film. It might make my top 10 list.
God, was but it this year?
Yeah, Holler was this year.
God, this has been a long year.
It's been a long year. We've seen a lot of movies.
Jesus.
Red Rocket, maybe not quite worth your time. I was a little disappointed by it.
Well, let's review the movies on a critically acclaimed scale. Again, for anyone's new or wants a refresher, we review films on a scale of C- to C+. The highest grade you can get from us is a C+. That is above average. We recommend you see it. Might be the best movie ever. It might just be quite good. We recommend you see it. It's a C+. C is average, well, some good, some bad, maybe better for some audiences than others, but a mixed bag. It's a C. It's average. And C- is below average. That's everything from we just don't generally recommend you run out and see this one to this is the worst thing we've ever seen. Mm-hmm. On that note, where does Red Rocket land?
It's a low C. It's okay. It's not quite a wash. There's, you know, I do appreciate the rawness of it. There's a, you know, something going on here that I was able to sort of latch onto, but it could have been so much better. And the lead character is just so grating that I ended up like sort of being stressed out at the end of it.
All right, what about Being the Ricardos?
Being the Ricardos is a C-. I did not like this movie. I feel like Aaron Sorkin didn't know what he was doing.
Yeah.
I feel like he bit off more than he can chew. I feel like the actors didn't even get a full fist around the characters other than Vivian Vance and William Frawley. Everyone else is just... And all the supporting players are Sorkin stock characters.
Yeah, they could have stepped in from any single one of his shows. I agree. This is a C-. I think I'm maybe a little bit... As detailed in my criticism as I may be, I think I'm a little less passionate about it than you are. But yeah, this is not a good film. I think this is a film that is coasting on, if Aaron Sorkin writes it so that it sounds important, it kind of feels important. But if you actually pay attention to the words and the actual, like, what's what it is trying to be conveyed and what is not successfully being conveyed, as opposed to just how important the scene sounds, this is a spectacularly empty, not very well-conceived film that is trying to shove a greatest hits compilation into what was really kind of an intimate tale. I think the leads are miscast, but I agree. Nina Arianda and J.K. Simmons are anchoring this pretty well.
Yeah,
I think every time they're on screen, the movie is better for it. So yeah, C minus for me. And then I'm really torn actually on West Side Story, because on one hand, so much of it is superlative, but I can't understate just how if the main romance doesn't work, the whole movie falls down a peg. So I think I'm going to wait and see how you land and maybe react accordingly. Where do you land on this?
I think there's far too much great stuff in this to not give it a C+.
Okay.
I love the dancing. I love the staging. I love the music. A lot of the supporting cast is incredible.
Incredible.
That the lead is miscast and that a lot of the love story doesn't play out isn't necessarily relevant when you're enjoying G. Officer Krupke that much. I feel like a lot of the musical numbers in a musical are what it's important.
Right.
And when they nail it as well as they did and as they did in this film, then I'm willing to forgive that sort of character problem and plotting problem.
I see your point, and I'll say this right now. While I can agree that, you know, it doesn't get in the way of G. Officer Krupke, it does get in the way of Maria or Tonight or any of the other songs that Tony is involved in. So I think it does hinder it. So I'm gonna say, since you give it a C+, and I agree with your overall points,
okay,
I'm going to give it a symbolic C. Where I agree with your point, but I don't think... I want to make it clear that I think this is... I think someone dropped the ball on this. And I know it was Ansel Elgort, but I think it was also just whoever decided to cast Ansel Elgort. This could have been epic. Like, timelessly epic. And instead, it's so damn good, except for this one really important part. So, I'm going to give it a C, but it's a high C.
All right.
And the things that you say are great are 100% great. And there's so many wonderful things about it, but it's a frustrating film for me. All right, and that is it for Critically Acclaimed this week. Thank you, everybody, for listening. We'll be back next week with something.
There's a lot. This is the end of the year, so we're getting a lot of the bigger releases.
They're cramming a lot of like Oscar stuff. Spider-Man comes out next week.
Oh, right.
So we'll be one of us at least will be reviewing the new Spider-Man.
I mean, I guess I'll try to see the new Spider-Man.
Oh, you poor thing. No, I'm sorry, what else is coming? Okay, so we got Spider-Man's coming out next week. We got bada-bing, bada-boom. There's another. Oh, the new Guillermo del Toro, Nightmare Alley.
Nightmare Alley comes out next week.
A new George Clooney film, The Tender Bar, comes out next week.
Starring Ben Affleck, who's in a lot of the acting conversations for awards. I don't like that a lot of the conversations we have to have about these movies are just in their award contenderness.
Yeah, that's not what's important here.
That is kind of what we're reacting to, because that's the way studios release them. They like to put their what they think should win awards right at the end of the year.
It's hard not to like incorporate that into the conversation, but it is where we are right now. And sometimes people are like award worthy. So The Lost Daughter is next week too, as well. Maggie Gyllenhaal's directorial debut. See
The Lost Daughter.
Yeah,
I'm going to try to see Drive My Car, which actually came out this week.
Yeah, I need to see that too.
But
I keep hearing it's amazing.
Yeah, it's for a new film from the director of Happy Hours, which I saw in Ovid this year. It's really, really, really wonderful. Yeah.
And then a week after that, we're going to have reviews of The Matrix Resurrection, The Tragedy of Macbeth, Sing 2,
Cyrano.
And then after that, basically the last like big review episode in December is where Whitney and I try to catch up on everything.
Yeah, we're going to do a year in review of the things we missed.
Yeah, and then the last week of December or the first week of January, depending on how the timing works out and the dates, I haven't checked the calendar, we're going to be doing our list of the best movies of the year. Which should be interesting because it's an interesting year with, frankly, a lot of really good movies in it.
Yeah, and my list is not going to look like yours. I
guarantee
you
that, but I have got some really interesting stuff on mine, and it's all in flux. I'm still catching up on a lot of things, a couple of big movies I haven't gotten around to. I haven't seen Drive My Car yet. I'm looking forward to that. Let's see, what are some of the other big ones I haven't seen yet? I haven't seen, I still haven't seen Belfast. I need to catch up on that.
I finally caught up on the movie Pig. The Nicolas Cage film. Too. I saw Pig.
I
haven't seen Zola. I haven't seen Shiva Baby. Those are two big ones I kept hearing about.
Only just today did I catch up on Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar, and you were 100% correct. That movie is amazing.
It's so funny.
That movie is absolute ludicrous, sublime silliness, and I'm so glad I made time for it.
The boy on his paper stops at a tree. He waves at an owl. The owl scans him with a laser beam. The tree opens up, and he goes into a supervillain's lair. Oh, my God.
It's great.
Barb and Star is hilarious. It's
great. Anyway, we'll talk more about Barb and Star, surely, and a bunch of other really great movies in a couple of weeks. But anyway, that's what's coming up next on Critically Acclaimed. We also have a lot of other shows here at our network. Thank you for enjoying all of those. Don't forget, you can always email us. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We might read your email in an upcoming episode of We've Got Mail, so feel free to ask us questions, take us to task, whatever you want to do. We also have a P.O. box. Whitney, what's our P.O. box?
Mail us a letter. We like that. P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
It's always a pleasure to hear from you in any format, but letters are just fun, aren't they?
I have a few other things I'd like to hype.
Go for it.
Because I'm still doing All About Ovid with B. Peterson. We have an episode coming up in a couple of days. Mm-hmm. We're going to do our December episode. It's a monthly thing.
Remember, All About Ovid is spelled with all O's. OLLOBOUT. OVID.
Oh, because Ovid is the streaming service.
Get it?
Ovid is the deep cut art house streaming service, and B and I watch stuff on it, and we like to talk about what we see because there's a lot of interesting stuff. I was on a podcast with Mark Radulich, and we talked about Wolf, Lamb, and Pig.
Hmm.
We called it the Hoofcore episode. It's a genre I just made up. Yeah, you can look. I did a live stream, but you can actually catch the episode on that.
It's awesome.
And my new radio show's finished.
Yeah.
If you're a $20 patron, you have access to it already. But if you're not a $20 patron, contact me on the social media, and I will sell it to you. The title is "She Began to Dance Around," and it's about a woman who is stalking Frosty the Snowman. About 22 minutes long. It stars my very, very talented friend, Chelsea Spirito. Yeah. And it's all just monologue into a tape recorder. And
she's amazing.
She's great in it.
She's
it's
fun.
It's unbelievably stupid. And I think you'll enjoy it.
And
it's very profane. It's R-rated. There's
and don't forget, Whitney has other radio dramas as well. And if you haven't downloaded those or got those already from him, maybe he can work out a deal. It's like a bulk rate or something.
Yeah, the more you get, the less you pay per show.
Yeah. Also, my partner and I have a soap store called Salt Cat Soap. It is on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook at Salt Cat Soap, all one word. We sell and make designer soaps, handcrafted, really smell great, lots of really cool designs. Some of them are very novel. They're all very novel, actually, but just some of them are ooh, we got some really cool stuff. We got like this holiday soap where it looks like a Christmas tree and some presents have been like frozen in a glacier, and they're all those individual pieces are made of soap. So as you wash the soap disappears, and then you have all these other mini soaps inside. It's really neat. Anyway, that's available on Etsy. You can look it up on Etsy, all one word, Salt Cat Soap, or you can find the link on our socials. Thank you everybody who's already bought some. The reviews have been really great, and we really, really appreciate it. Anyway, and of course, big thank you to all of our patrons over at patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. We have a lot of exclusive shows on the Critically Acclaimed Network Patreon, including shows about Star Trek, Batman, the Academy Awards, commentary tracks. We got a lot of stuff coming up. It's very, very exciting. And thank you, everybody, once again. Without your contributions, we would not be able to keep the show going. Mm-hmm. So thank you so much for making that possible. It means the world to us. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And on that note, we're gonna say goodbye for now. Never forget, everyone's a critic.
I want to go to the midnight show. I'm sorry, what?